This session is the second installment of the three-part Spring 2022 Progress in Research webinar series. Today's webinar will feature four research projects developing novel tools to remove chlorinated compounds from the environment. If you missed the first webinar on per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, the recorded archive is now available on the CLUIN website. The final session of this series will be on Friday, May 13th, and we'll focus on plant and fungal-based bioremediation. With that, we are now ready to get started. First, we will hear from Dr. Yunang Tang and Dr. Yuxiao Shen. Dr. Tang is an associate professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering in the College of Engineering at Florida State University. Dr. Shen is an assistant professor in the Department of Civil, Environmental, and Construction Engineering at Texas Tech University. You can read full bios for all our presenters on the CLUIN website. Dr. Tang and Dr. Shen, I will now turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Cindy. So let me share my screen. Okay. So thanks, Cindy, for the introduction. So hello, everyone. So my name is Yuxiao Shen from Texas Tech University. Today, I'll be presenting with Yunang Tang from Florida State University. So our NIEHS topic is enhancing bioremediation of groundwater co-contaminated by chlorinated volatile organic compounds and 1,4-dioxane using novel macrocyclic materials. So first, we have a big team. So Dr. Tang from Florida State University leads two students working on bioremediations. And Dr. Josh Howe and I lead three students from Texas Tech University. So we are working on material synthesis and the design. So Mr. Joe from GeoSynTech will join us like in the monthly regular meetings to discuss about the project progress. So we will join him in the year 4 and the year 5 of the project. So for the senior advisors, we have support from GeoSynTech and EPA, Neil Durant, Dorian Graves, and Jimmy Cummins. For the laboratory tests, we have support from Serum and the University of Illinois at Chicago. So back to our problems. So our problem is originated from the groundwater contaminations. So 1,4-dioxane is a very common organic solvent that is used for stabilizer of CVOCs. So the first problem is their concentration is really low. It's very difficult to remove them completely. So because these two components coexist with each other, so the CVOC's existence will inhibit 1,4-dioxane biodegradation. So the third problem is these two components need to complete opposite environmental conditions for biodegradation. For 1,4-dioxane, they need aerobic, and for CVOCs, they need anaerobic. So based on the problem analysis, we propose a solution that made up two components. The first component is we try to cultivate some bacteria that can efficiently degrade 1,4-dioxane at very low concentrations. The second component of the solution is we try to develop novel macrocyclic solvents. We try to make two kinds of solvents that can physically efficiently remove 1,4-dioxane and CVOCs. Based on the solutions, we have different aims. The first aim is led by Texas Tech universities. We are doing computational simulations, synthesis, material calculation to screen some highly efficient sorbent that can separate 1,4-dioxane and the CVOCs. The second aim is led by Florida State University. They are doing culture enrichment, isolation, and post-characterization to screen some bacteria that can efficiently remove 1,4-dioxane at very low concentration. When the goals of these two aims are achieved, we are going to interact with each other in the year 3, and then we are going to test our material enhanced bioremediation, this concept. And then after that, we are going to conduct a colon study at GeoSynTech. So basically, our research is fundamental research. But we also cover technology development. That's why we collaborate with GeoSyntec. So let's back on to the progress of our project in the year one. So first we conduct the material design and the synthesis. So first we conduct three achievements in the modeling part. So for the first target, we try to identify the most abundant, most probable conformer for our macrocycles, because these studies have been seldom studied before. For example, this pillar six ring macrocycle molecules, because the molecules can rotate, can interact with each other. So we first find the C7 is the most abundant conformer for the pillar six ring. So we'll use it as a representative molecule in the later simulations. So the second part of the problem is trying to probe the transport of the barrier relating the adsorption in different tests of macrocycles. So basically, you can see this is the macrocycles, and we probe a variety of contaminants from the entrance to the cavity, and then we see the energy change. So I don't know why this figure didn't show up here. So then, based on these two problems, and then we analysis the material based on the strength and adsorption of CVOC and the 1,4 dioxin in pillar six ring based on macrocycles. And then we can see the binding energies. We can see slightly more negative binding energies for 1,4 dioxin compared to CVOC, which means they are energetically more favorable to bind the 1,4 dioxin, but this difference is marginal. So this is the progress of our modeling side. So my group is also at the same time doing some synthesis. In addition to pillar six ring, we are also investigating some other macrocycle-based adsorbents, such as cyclodextrin and the resorcing array. They have different shape and they have different chemical environment. We also use different cross-linkers to endow the final adsorbents with different chemistry, such as neutral adsorbent, anionic adsorbent, and a fluorine adsorbent. So for the first year, we are synthesizing the beta-cyclodextrin-based solvent and also pillarine-based solvent based on the synthesis. So we also studied the pillar six ring, but we find that the selectivity is not that significant as indicated by the simulations. That's why we are moving on the beta-cyclodextrin-based solvent. And this is also being modeled by our group by Josh from Texas Tech. And we synthesize the three kinds of solvents. The first solvent is anionic, the later two solvents are neutral. And then we find some interesting selectivities. So compared to a commercial solvent, the active carbon and the amazolve, they actually have pretty high removal rate when dealing with very low ppb level, around 50 to 100 ppb level, 1,4 dioxin and the CVOCs, but they have no selectivity. But for our solvent, like solvent one and three, and we find no removal for 1,4 dioxin, but they have selective removal of CVOC. Although the removal rate is a little bit slow, we are going to improve it in our later studies. In the adsorption three, we also see these kind of selectivities. So this is the progress of our specific M1. Let's move on to let Dr. Tan to introduce the progress of specific M2.
Thank you, Yue Xiao. Hello, everyone. The second specific aim is mechanistic understanding of a highly efficient 1,4 dioxin metabolizing culture. We have maintained this mixed culture in the lab for a few years. We know that it can degrade 1,4 dioxin at ppb levels. Our major hypothesis is that this mixed culture contains species that can degrade 1,4 dioxin at low concentrations, and that they can be isolated. And the methods that we used for enrichment and isolation are similar to the literature. For example, we used centrifugation combined with dilution. The major difference is that we use low 1,4 dioxin concentrations. As you can see from the figure above, the concentration is 1 milligrams per liter or less. And in the end, we successfully enriched six cultures as shown in the six bottles respectively. they can be further divided into two groups. The three bottles on the left originated from a landfill leachate, and the three bottles on the right originated from an activated sludge. There's a big difference in the color of the cultures: green for landfill leachate, but brown for the activated sludge. The next step is to transfer the mixed cultures into agar plates so that we can isolate them. And we see a lot of isolated colonies. Then we further transfer the isolated colonies separately into culture bottles, and we obtained 54 isolated cultures. And we also tested their ability to degrade 1,4 dioxin in the culture bottles, and we confirmed that 85% of the isolated cultures could degrade 1,4 dioxin. The next step is to find what these isolated cultures are, and we sequenced the 16 SR DNA and then plots the results in this phylogenetic tree, which is on the right side. And we started with 5 cultures, and they are in the red circles. Some of the cultures are closely related to cultures that are known to be able to degrade 1,4 dioxin in the literature, and some are not and could be more novel compared to the other three. And then next question that we want to answer is, how good are they in degrading 1,4 dioxin? So we did a kinetics experiments, and we focused on, we started with the green, the culture in the green circle. And then we did a batch butter experiments. We monitored the 1,4 dioxin concentration, which is shown in the pink diamonds. And we also monitored the biomass concentration, which is shown in green triangles. At the same time, we developed a model based on the two equations on the right side. And by feeding the model with experimental data, we determined the kinetics parameters, which is in red. And after getting these parameters, we compared them with the literature. We first look at the parameter Ks, which is the half maximum rate concentration. And Bishop, can we go to the next slide? Thank you. And the result for the isolated culture in our study is in green. And the literature results are shown in blue for the pure cultures and orange for mixed cultures. For the half maximum rate concentration, the culture that we isolated has the a Ks that is close to the lowest reported in the literature, meaning that this culture can reach its maximum growth potential at a very low 1,4 dioxin concentration. That is a characteristic we were looking for. We also compared some other kinetics parameters and found that this culture had a low biomass decay rate, high biomass yield, and low maximum specific utilization rate, which is not surprising because we use the low 1,4 dioxin concentration to enrich them. So based on these characteristics, we think it seems to be a good fit for 1,4 dioxin degradation at low concentrations. And with that, I would like to make conclusions for the specific aims that we have already worked on. Specific M1 focused on material research. Regarding modeling, we have simulated pillar 6 ring and found that they are weakly selective for 1,4 dioxin over chlorinated compounds. And our experiments confirmed this modeling results. Because the selectivity is weak, so we switched to another adsorbent later, which is beta cyclodextrin. On the other hand, this adsorbent showed strong selectivity towards chlorinated volatile organic compounds when both 1,4 dioxin and chlorinated volatile organic compounds are present. And then in the second specific end, which focused on microbial research, we have in which the six cultures, mixed cultures, and identified the five pure cultures and characterized the one pure culture, which seemed to be a good fit for degrading one-fold auxin at low concentrations. Looking at our progress, this is a five-year project. We are currently in early year two, and we have four specific ends. For specific M1, the material research, we have already synthesized material that can selectively absorb CVOCs. What we want to do next is to focus on synthesizing material that can selectively absorb one-fold auxin. For specific M2, which focuses on microbial research, we have already enriched the six mixed cultures, isolated 54 pure cultures, and characterized one efficient pure culture. And our plan is to keep characterizing more pure cultures that we have already isolated. And once we have that microbial pure culture and the materials, then in specific M3, we will study their interactions. And in specific M4, we will study their interactions in the columns. With that, I would like to thank the NIEHS for funding, and thank you all for your attention.
Thank you. We'll now take questions for Drs. Tang and Chen. As I mentioned before, you may submit your questions using the Q&A pods down in the lower right corner. I do see one question here. How would this technology be applied at a site with both 1,4-dioxane and chlorinated compounds?
Maybe I can take the first shot. Let's first talk about ex situ remediation. We could have two stages, so that in the first stage, we put in a material that selectively absorb chlorinated compounds, and that material will be supplemented with bacteria that can degrade the chlorinated compounds. And then, because they did not absorb 1,4-dioxane, so 1,4-dioxane will be treated in the second stage. Again, we will use another type of material combined with biomass to degrade them. So that means the two groups of contaminants are degraded separately because material, the selectivity of the material that was possible.
Do you see that working the same way in an in situ application?
I think potentially it could be applied to in situ applications, so that the if we inject the media, the attachment, the absorbents and bacteria into the source zone, they will take care of the chlorinated compounds first, leaving the 1,4-dioxane to be treated far away from the source zone. So, but the techniques will be slightly different because we cannot inject the big absorbents into the subsurface area. We need to use smaller absorbents, which is also part of our scope of work.
Great, thank you. Okay, I'll just remind folks to put their questions into the Q&A. I have another one for you here. So have you run into any intermediates from the 1,4-dioxane biodegradation?
Well, I think that's a very important aspect of the second specific M. We measured 1,4-dioxane and its intermediates for the pure culture that we have already isolated. And for the first pure culture that we characterized, we did not see intermediates production. And that conclusion is based on two observations. First, we measured the chemical oxygen demand and found that all the chemical oxygen demand during the degradation was contributed by 1,4-dioxane, which means no intermediates existed. If they existed, they would be negligible in concentration. And we also used gas chromatography, mass spectrometry to see if we can detect any intermediates. We did not see any intermediates from there. So for the first culture, there's no intermediate production, but we will see the other cultures, maybe some of them can produce intermediates.
Further investigation required. All right, thank you. Let's see. So there is one of the participants asked, adsorption would not result in compound degradation. So what is your plan on dealing with adsorbing material after adsorption?
Yes, so that can take these questions. So that actually is what we do, right? So we develop materials that can selectively remove those two components. And then Dr. Tang developed a bacteria that can efficiently degrade the 1,4-dioxane. And then at the same time, bacteria degrading CVOC has been already well studied. So they have very mature culture that can degrade efficiently. Then in the year three, when we two teams come together, and then we will have one material that can selectively remove 1,4-dioxane, and then that will have bacteria attached on that. And then to further degrade the 1,4-dioxane because it's a bacteria, it's a concentration enriched colon. And then we have another colon has CVOC enriched that can develop for a CVOC degradation. So we will integrate our two teams together to see the material enhance the biodegradation. That's what's our plan.
And we hope to report that results in our third year presentation like this one.
Great, thank you. I have a couple more questions for you here. Can you talk a little about how computer simulation interacts or helps with your material design experiments?
Yes, that's a good question. So I think the selectivity is very important. So based on the computational simulations, they will tell us that what's the like binding efficiency, binding preference for these two contaminants because they're very, very similar. As we mentioned that the pillar six, we already did some study, we find that their difference is marginal and we don't see a good selectivity. So then our team will also study the other macrocycle ring. So if the ring doesn't really tell the difference, so then we will move on to the cross linker to show that what internal chemistry like hydrophobicity will tell us. So based on their side and also based on our experiment side, because we will do parallel together, right? And then we will try to select the best sorbents that can efficiently differentiate these two chemicals.
Thank you. Okay, I have another question for you. What separation efficiency do you hope to achieve in the 1,4-dioxane and CVOC mixture?
That's also a good question. So far we don't know what's the detail because everything is in ppb levels. So we want to know, for example, so if we selectively remove the CVOC, so what's the left CVOC concentrations won't be inhibit the 1,4-dioxane degradation. I think that's something we need to investigate. So that's the key important part. So we can leave some CVOC left, but we don't want to inhibit the 1,4-dioxane degradations.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you.
I also want to add on the criteria on that separation. So the first thing is to separate. In the end, we hope the microorganisms will be able to degrade all of them. So hopefully there will be no contaminants come out of uh, the, the treated water in the end.
Thank you. Okay, I do not see any more questions in the chat, in the Q&A pod. So if anyone has any more questions, please put them in now. Otherwise, Dr. Shen or Tang, do you have any other comments you'd like to make before we move to our next speakers?
Just want to thank everyone for attending the presentation, this webinar, and also for the questions. Thank you.
So I'll stop the sharing.
Thank you. Okay, and if anyone has any further questions, remember you can put those in the Q&A pod and we will pass those along. Okay, next we will hear from Dr. Louis Semprini. Dr. Semprini studies biological processes for the treatment of hazardous wastes and on the fate and transport of organic contaminants in the environment at Oregon State University. Dr. Semprini, I will now turn it over to you.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity for us to present our work today. Today, I'm going to discuss about development of passive, sustainable co-metabolic systems for the treatment of complex mixtures by encapsulating microbial cultures in slow-release substrates and hydrogels. And my collaborators at OSU are Skip Roachford, who's doing material science, and Caitlin Fogg, and Mike Hyman, who keeps us honest on the microbiology at Oregon, North Carolina State University. So our first talk was a great introduction to my talk. We out in the environment, we have very long plumes, for example, of 1,4-dioxane that are costly to treat. And shown in the upper left here is a plume in Fort Carson. That's several thousand feet long that has 1,4-dioxane concentrations above 10 micrograms per liter. And so it's really very difficult to treat a whole plume at those types of concentrations. So one potential solution is creating passive systems for treating these plumes via aerobic co-metabolism. And what we're working on here is encapsulating pure cultures along with slow-release substrates to drive the co-metabolism in hydrogels. And then the contaminants would diffuse into the hydrogels to be degraded. And the preliminary work on this concept was funded by CERTIP. So the microorganism that is doing the work for us is Rhodococcus rhodicus 21198. Shown here, it grows nice and orange on a petri dish. Our original studies were when you carry out co-metabolism, where you stimulated this microorganism with growth on isobutane as a gaseous substrate. It has a short chain alkene monooxygenase that initiates the oxidation. And here is shown the initial start of the co-metabolism of cis-DCE to an epoxide. In our work with isobutane, we showed a broad range of chlorinated aliphatic hydrocarbons and 1,4 could be simultaneously degraded by this microorganism. Mike Hyman at North Carolina State developed a fluorescent labeling method where we could label components of that short chain monooxygenase enzyme. And what's shown here on the right is a labeling pattern with growth of 21198 on different substrates. And in lane one is shown grown on isobutane, very thick banding pattern here. But also when we grew it on 2-butanol, we also see a banding pattern indicating that the monooxygenase was developed with growth on 2-butanol. And we also tested 1-butanol, did not see a lot of banding pattern. But when we went over and looked at the transformation of 1,4-dioxane after growth on these two alcohols, we saw very rapid transformation of 1,4-dioxane after growth on 2-butanol. And then with some lag, eventually we saw transformation of 1,4-dioxane on 1-butanol as well. So this brings up the concept of creating alcohols to drive the co-metabolic transformation. The way we do that is putting an orthosilicate inside our hydrogel. And an orthosilicate here has these oxygen bridges to molecules that will then make the alcohol. And this would be by just hydrolysis with water, it would slowly produce alcohols over time. So here we could encapsulate different orthosilicates to make different alcohols. And we've worked with both T-Boss here and 2-T-Boss that makes 2-butanol. And 2-T-Boss hydrolyzes at a rate about a factor of 20 slower than T-Boss. So in this technology, you have some control of the rate of hydrolysis by the orthosilicate you actually encapsulate. Well, getting back to the CERTIP studies, what we did is we developed methods to encapsulate the microorganism and the slow-release substrate in gel and gum beads. And this shows a column packed with these gel and gum beads. And early on in starting to flow groundwater that was contaminated with a mixture of cis-DCE, 1,1-TCA, and 1,4-doxane. Over time, you see this development on the right of the orange color throughout the whole column. This is 21198 growing up in the hydrogel beads, okay? So with prolonged stimulation, we get complete 21198 throughout the whole column with the gel and gum beads. And this shows the removal of the mixture of the three contaminants, and they were all at 250 micrograms per liter. And out here, we're getting over 99% removal of all three contaminants with a hydraulic residence time of about a half a day in the column. So this was kind of the proof of concept of this technology. So having that in our NIHS project, we're kind of able to leapfrog and get into things we want to do in AIM-3. And that's actually use the beads in an engineered system. And this is we created in the lab in a very large physical aquifer model, a funnel gate system. And this shows the funnel gate system in here. Where we have the gates and the potential to create bioreactors. And then it's filled with sand. And over on the right, it shows us packing them with gel and gum beads. So having the gel and gum beads in hand already, we're able to kind of leapfrog into AIM-3 experiments of creating a funneling gate system to try and treat the contaminants. Shown here in that system is the initial biostimulation. So early on, these beads we packed liberated 1-butanol. Early on, 1-butanol is liberated into the solution we're sampling. But then with time, 1-butanol gets completely consumed. So the microorganisms are growing up in the gel and gum beads. And also show here, this is inside the reactor, the solid orange. Shown in red is the effluent, where we collect all the fluid coming out of the physical aquifer model. And we see butanol concentrations decreasing with time. And on the right is dissolved oxygen. So the dissolved oxygen decreasing with time also indicates the biostimulation of the beads within that reactor that we emplaced in the system. So we carried it out in the system here. We carried out some tests with a surrogate. And a surrogate is a compound that will be co-metabolized. And we could look at the epoxide that's formed. So what we fed to the physical aquifer model is isobutene that is co-metabolized over to isobutene oxide, kind of as a surrogate before we start going and doing experiments with chlorinated solvents and 1,4-doxane. And what we see here in the green is the buildup of the epoxide that is formed as we flow through that permeable reactor barrier that we created with the gel and gum beads. And in blue is the isobutene shown to be at very low concentration. So we confirm co-metabolism occurring in that bead pack 150 days after we actually had in place the beads in that reactive barrier. And on the right is shown effluent concentrations from the reactor where we collect all the effluent coming out. And we see the epoxide in the effluent, but at lower concentrations, indicating there might be fluid flowing around that funneling gate. that maybe not all the fluid is interacting within that funnel and gate, which is part of the design of our experiments to try and figure out if that is going on. We then moved on to a chlorinated solvent in the PAM, a 1,2-dichloroethane. We did this because in the lab, it has reaction rates around that of 1,4-dioxane. But we wanted to test it out with a chlorinated solvent first. And what's shown here is in the brown on the bottom is the concentration in that reactive reactor in the funnel and gate. And the blue is up gradient of that. So the contaminant concentrations that would be mixing and flowing into that funnel and gate, right? And what we show is about a 60 to 70% removal, okay, of 1,2-dichloroethane in this reactive system. The red shows collecting all the fluid at the end of the reactor. And what we're showing here is there is unreacted 1,2-dichloroethane. There is fluid that is likely flowing around that funnel and gate system and bypassing it. And this was also backed up by bromide tracer tests. So what we have tests going on the sides of the funnel and gate and in the funnel and gate, and the bromide tracer tests are indicating that we do get flow around the funnel and gate, but the orange in the middle shows bromide going into the funnel and gate as well. So a lot of work on how do you actually conduct experiments in these physical aquifer models to try and figure out what is happening in these reactive systems. So moving on to the material science part of our project. In the material science side, we're trying to develop stronger, longer lasting beads that we could mass produce easily and both co-encapsulate the slow release substrate and the microorganism. And we're using design of experiments to look at the matrix of conditions you would study in developing these hydrogels. So this is statistical method of trying to cut down the number of experiments you do, but also get a broad range of cover. So you could statistically predict which is the best gel and gum bead that you made over a range of conditions, right? And here you put inputs into the model. What we're dealing with is changing polymer concentrations and changing the time that we cross-link to make the hydrogel beads. And then you have responses that you measure. And one is how strong are the beads, how well they carry out co-metabolism, what is the oxygen consumption that's occurring. So there's a whole statistical basis for making judgments on how well you're making the hydrogel beads. This just shows the process conditions. Our studies in the first year are with beads that are made of polyvinyl alcohol and alginate to make the hydrogels. We develop a system where we get all the components together in a series. And just with a simple syringe pump, we drop beads into a cross-linking solution to make the beads. And then we carry them out to do batch reactive experiments in the lab. And this just shows a simple procedure for making the hydrogel beads, right? So we're kind of, the emulsions are up in here with a syringe, they're dropped into a beaker where they're cross-linked, and they make these beads that are shown on the right-hand side over here. So in the design of the experiments, what are we measuring after we make the beads? Well, one is we're measuring compression. So we do compression tests on the hydrogel beads to see how strong they are. And the blue is one day right after we make the beads. And the orange is 30 days after microbes have grown up in the beads. In a batch incubation, they've been on a shaker table for 30 days shaking around. So we see that we do get decrease in strength, which is we're trying to make these so they'd hold up for a long period of time. So one of the measurements over a broad range of experiments we conducted, right? And what we see down here is the ability to co-metabolize cis-DCE. And actually that improves and gets faster with time from one day to 30 days, indicating microbes are actually growing up in the beads. And all the beads were capable of co-metabolism. So we developed a process that the microorganisms survive, they're doing well in the hydrogel beads. And then over on the right here is showing oxygen uptake. And it's been an interesting observation because we actually see more oxygen uptake at early time than at 30 days. And that gives a question, you know, what is actually going on? Is this related to diffusional properties or things like that in the beads? So a lot to try and understand when we fabricate and use these hydrogels. And what you get out of the model when you run these strange range of conditions is you could actually make contour plots of the results of the experiment. So this is the concentration of alginate we put in the bead and the concentration of PVA and the mixtures. And as one would predict, the strongest beads are made when you have the highest polymer concentration. And as you go lower in polymer concentration, the beads are not as strong. What is also shown here in an opposite trend is oxygen consumption. And what we're saying is we have highest rates of oxygen consumption on day one in beads that have the lowest polymer concentration, right? We're trying to think about what could be going on here. And it could be the matrix formed. As you get more and more polymer in solution, you might be making a tighter matrix, which is slowing down the rate of diffusion into the beads. So there's a lot going on here related to the material science and how we could actually test beads. And again, the model is responsive into the measurements that you decide to make on the beads. Okay, so with that, we're kind of going back to our columns again. So with this, we're going back to our columns. And now these are the columns that are now packed with the new hydrogel beads that we're fabricating, right? And so these, we have 2% polyvinyl alcohol and alginate, and we using T-Boss that's gonna liberate 1 butanol to grow the culture. We have side ports to look at gradients in the system. And we, in these systems, as a supply of oxygen, we are adding hydrogen peroxide in the system. What is shown here, earlier on, we saw a column that was completely orange with the gel and gum beads. Now we're starting here, you could see the orange color on the bottom of the column starting to develop as we get into biostimulating the beads. So what happened? So we're looking at cis-DCE in the column, and we're operated these now for about 90 pore volumes of flow through the column. And what we're getting is over 95% removal of cis-DCE in the column with a hydraulic resonance time of about a half day, with most of the activity coming in the very front of the column. We also see the production of the epoxide that we'd expect of cis-DCE. Here is early epoxide being measured. And then with time, it's decreasing. So what we're seeing is an increase in efficiency over time, and also the ability to co-metabolize the epoxide, which is bringing it towards complete mineralization. So we actually see out of the effluent of the column, the epoxide concentrations decreasing with time as well. One of the things we're seeing is that we don't have enough oxygen in the column, and we actually see 1 butanol coming out the end of the column. So our rate of hydrolysis in these first tests is fairly high, and we've had to add hydrogen peroxide in order to consume the butanol. And we can see that here. On the bottom, you could see that we're running out of oxygen in the effluent of the column. So we haven't gotten stimulation, that nice orange color yet over the complete column that we have here. So a little bit on summary, on bead optimization, we've developed a fabrication method for immobilization of both our microbial culture and our slow release substrate that should permit easier mass production of hydrogel beads in practice. This design of experiment method was successfully applied in the experiments to investigate different polymer concentrations and different cross-linking times. And we picked the variables we're measuring in those tests. A lot of tests to do. So one is bead compression, oxygen uptake, co-metabolism of the beads, right? And as expected, the PVA alginate hydrogel strength is correlated with the concentration of the polymer. So you go up in strength, the higher the concentration of the polymer in the system. On the bead application, we have a proof of concept on the funnel and gate system using a big physical aquifer model to create a reactive barrier. We did this with our original gel and gum beads to see how well they would work in that funnel and gate system. We've seen co-metabolism of our surrogate, isobutene, and 1,2-DCA. And this has been observed 1 year after the gel and gum beads were put in place in the reactor. So co-metabolism has been going on for a year within the reactor, but we do see bypass issues that we need to understand better through tracer tests and modeling of that system. And then we're now getting to test in the columns our new made hydrogel beads. Right now we're looking at co-metabolism of cis-DCE. We will move up in the columns to 1,4-dioxane and other mixtures of contaminants in the flow through columns and other types of bead formulations and conditions. But right now we're getting over 95% removal of the cis-DCE, and we haven't even stimulated the whole column yet of the gel and gum beads. With that, I'd like to thank people working on the project. Skip Rovtrert and Caitlin Fogg are doing all the hydrogel fabrication experiments and the DOE modeling. Mohammed Azizan helps out in putting that big physical aquifer model together and getting it running. Mike Hyman is working on the microbiology at North Carolina State, along with Kriti Smith. And then our trainees, Connor Harris is the PhD student that has done all the hydrogel development and work with the DOE model. Jacob Wartkohler has operated the big physical aquifer model with the funnel and gate. And Sean Conway is working on the column study that I talked about at the end of the experiment. And with that, I'd like to thank NIHS for the funding opportunity. And hopefully I have time for some questions.
Thank you, Dr. Semprini. Yes, we do have time for some questions, and we have a few for you here. So first question, and I've heard this about PRBs all over the place, so it's not just your experiment. How do you avoid flow around that barrier?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's why we actually set it up that there's room around the funnel and gate for the flow to go around it. So if we look at the construction, we left gaps to the side. So that flow, if we dig in, and it's a big thing to think about, clogging of that permeable reactive barrier over time, and would you get flow short circuiting and going around the funnel and gate? And that's what we actually looks like was going on in our first experiment. And that's with trying to create hydrogel beads that are really robust, right? When you pack them in there, they won't disintegrate, they would maintain their shape, and hopefully, maintain their permeability. But that's a really good question. And that's why we're trying to do experiments in that physical model to try and look at that.
Excellent. Thank you. We've got a couple of questions about oxygen. So how was the treatment affected by a decrease in dissolved oxygen?
Yeah, what happened there is we're not seeing right now, even when we analyze the ports, where I didn't have time to show that data on the column, the three ports, we see most of the activity is in the first half of the column. And then we run out of oxygen and we're not getting stimulation of the beads in the upper half of the column, right? And in that first experiment, the rates of oxygen or the rates of hydrolysis has been high, higher than we saw in past column tests with the new beads. And so we've had to add hydrogen peroxide. In past experiments with prolonged use of the column, rates of hydrolysis have dropped off and we're able to just use dissolved oxygen. But right now we're having to feed hydrogen peroxide as an additional source, in the system. And it is trying to develop systems that really consume low rates of oxygen right in the real world, because if you want to do things in a passive mode, you're going to need low oxygen utilization. Yeah.
Thank you. Now, one participant asked, or they mentioned the addition of hydrogen peroxide can form radicals, which would help in contaminant oxidation, but at the same time might harm your bacterial colonies. So what are your thoughts on the trade-off between contaminant removal and low bacterial abundance?
Yeah, that's a good one. So the interesting thing is, these microorganisms, they're gram positive. They're pretty tough critters, they seem to be able, we're adding pretty high hydrogen peroxide and they've been able to tolerate that, in these systems. And it is surprising because we've gone up at some pretty high hydrogen peroxide concentrations. And they seem to be able to, now we don't know, the gradient, and if ones are being harmed early on, say in that column versus later, right? But they seem to be able to tolerate it. The other thing here is one could go to the orthosilicate that makes 2-T-boss hydrolyzes at a rate of factor 20 lower than that T-boss. So you would bring down the whole rate of microbial activity by this slower rate of hydrolysis. And you would likely, in our earlier column studies in the CERTA project, we didn't even have to add hydrogen peroxide when we are looking at a slower release substrate in the system. So you also have control of this slow release substrate that you choose and the rate at which they hydrolyze, because that's based on the structure of that orthosilicate.
Thank you. Let's see, I think we've got a related question here. You might have answered some of that already, but what do you think is the sweet spot for dissolved oxygen, and how would you amend that dissolved oxygen in the field application?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you could think of this one is that we have to think about that there's diffusion into the beads, right? And so whenever you think about diffusion, you think about gradients of oxygen. We see this in biofilm studies that we do, right? And so you really need that oxygen in the bead, right? And so we're measuring the bulk solution of oxygen, but then it's a question, what is the actual oxygen inside that bead? I'm starting just by empirical evidence coming up with that you'd like to have around 2 milligrams per liter of dissolved oxygen out in that bulk solution in order to account for diffusion of oxygen into the beads. And you almost get back to typical things we look at in wastewater treatment, right? You want to maintain oxygen levels, okay, at a certain level in order to get diffusion into flux and things like that. So oxygen is critical. We could also think, and maybe as we go along here, thinking of the slow release forms of oxygen, the solid release forms of oxygen in combination with the beads to try and make this a completely, passive system. Okay. And so that is a potential study in the future.
Great. Thank you. Okay. I think it's time for us to move to our next speaker. So thank you again, Dr. Semprini. And we will go on now to, next we will hear from Dr. Tim Mattis and Dr. Wenxing Su. So Dr. Mattis is a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa. Dr. Su is an associate professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Villanova University. Dr. Mattis and Dr. Su, I will now turn it over to you.
Hey, thank you. So let's see. All right. Well, thanks for the introduction. And here is the title of our project. And it's been a bit of a long title, but really what it boils down to is that it's materials and microbes working together, which is in the spirit of this whole webinar series with chlorinated solvents. So I'm the PI, Tim Mattis, and Wenxing Su is the co-PI. It's a collaborative effort between the University of Iowa and Villanova. And I'm going to be acknowledging funding from NIEHS Superfund research program here up front. And so the purpose of this project and the problem that we're addressing is, first off, the chlorinated ethene. So PCE and TCE, these are common groundwater contaminants, and in situ anaerobic bioremediation of these compounds is fairly widespread. Utilizing organohalide respiring bacteria, or OHRB. And so many of you probably seen this pathway before. This is the full dechlorination pathway of PC and TC all the way through cis-DC, vinyl chloride, and to ethene, which is the desired end product. But as it's pretty well known that the limitations of this approach is the accumulation of cis-DC and vinyl chloride in the field. There's a variety of reasons for that. Bioaugmentation is often done for, in the case of there might not be the right organisms present. And there also could be other things like toxic co-contaminants. Chloroform is just shown as an example here. Many of you who know me, I've been working on this problem for a while, but actually from the aerobic side, so it's kind of interesting to come in from the anaerobic side for once. And part of the reason came interested was for some of these reports of what we're calling pyrogenic carbonaceous matter, PCM. Let's have a picture of this. It's things like activated carbon, colloidal activated carbon, biochars, showing some promise in promoting OHRB-driven bioremediation. A lot of these reports are mostly anecdotal, but we're interested in how these materials are and their properties specifically are shaping the microbial community interactions that could lead to enhanced bioremediation. So that's what we're doing in this project, is doing microbial ecology and material science with the goal of developing a tailored PCM that ultimately will improve halogenic organic pollutant bioremediation outcomes. And some of the hypotheses that we're working under are that these materials are somehow improving microbial community, or interacting with microbial communities and positively influencing dehalogenation. Another idea that we're working under is taking advantage of the sorptive capabilities of PCM that could be used to maybe sequester away recalcitrant or otherwise inhibitory compounds for OHRB. Quick primer on what OHRB are doing. They use in the environment, they use reductive dehalogenase enzymes called RDases to catalyze chloroethene dechlorination. I'm showing a picture of a cell schematic here. A lot of OHRB use hydrogen as electron donor, and then they shuttle those electrons over to the reductive dehalogenase, which contains a coronoid cofactor that catalyzes that dechlorination. And so in bacteria that are doing chlorinated ethene dechlorination, there's four main RDases: PCEA, TCA, BCRA, and BBCA. And PCA converts basically PC to TCE. TCA can take TCE all the way through cis, vinyl, and to ethene. And then BCRA and BBCA are kind of the main vinyl chloride reductive dehalogenases. They can convert cis DCE and vinyl chloride to ethene. And so that's the idea here, is promoting complete dechlorination to ethene. And this is a study. We're working with a culture, a mixed culture called SDC9. It's a PC dechlorinating culture. It's commercially available. You can, it sometimes comes through Paul Hetzinger at Aptum. That's where I get this culture from, and used in bioaugmentation frequently. And there was a study a couple of years ago with some metagenomics and proteomics showing that this culture is the main OHRB is Dehalococcoides, about 15 to 20% Dehalococcoides. There's also desulfidobacterium present that does some of the work. And this phylogenetic tree on the left is showing different RDases in the culture. So there are some PCEA RDases, which it looks like is possessed by the desulfidobacterium. And then the Dehalococcoides species there have the enzymes BCRA and TCEA. So that's what we're doing. And so then the idea is that back with these materials that we were interested in, there's some products out there, some colloidal activated carbons, powdered activated carbons, maybe even biochars. We were looking at the interactions of biochar, a poplar biochar, which happened to have around the lab, with this SDC9 culture. So when we get it, it's actually pretty happy, and it's making ethene, but it doesn't take very long. It's actually grown often in a chemostat type of situation, and then we start working with it in batch. But on the left-hand side here, when there's no biochar present, just in a liquid culture, it's not that difficult to get the culture a little bit unhappy and just start accumulating cis-DCE. And it starts making vinyl chloride maybe after about 40 days or so. But so what's interesting, and what we found, was that when you take the same culture and you incubate it in the presence of this poplar biochar, I don't know if it's anything special about the poplar feedstock or anything like that, but it just it's able to move past cis-DC and form completely dechlorinate everything to ethene. So we thought that was an interesting observation. And then it's really not the material doing it, it's materials and the microbes working together. And that's kind of illustrated by some of these results where we're looking at some biomarkers in the culture for Dihelicocoides 16S, BCRA and TCEA genes. And so in the cultures without biochar, the Dihelicocoides aren't growing so much up until about day 40 or so, you saw a little bit of vonochloride being produced. But in the cultures with biochar, there's several orders of magnitude more Dihelicocoides with these genes, BCRA and TCA, that can do this complete conversion of cis-DC to ethene. And in the, we also extracted DNA from the biochar. So these Dihelicocoides are actually attaching to the biochar and they have the BCRA and TCA genes. So again, this points to some interaction and an attachment, direct attachment of Dihelicocoides to other, possibly other OHRB to the biochar. And that leads us to kind of the questions that we're working on in this project. And I'll have Wen Qing talk to you about AIM-1 here in just a second, where about this tunable PCM platform for synthesizing PCM-like polymers. So we're interested in zeroing in on specific properties of the materials that somehow lead to this enhanced bioremediation. And then once we have these different materials, we can work with how they interact with the microbial culture, ideally leading to finding out which ones promote more ethene formation versus others. And then eventually moving on to an AIM-3, the development of a tailored PCM that can be deployed in the field and could also possibly be used for not just chlorinated ethenes, but maybe other types of chlorinated compounds that are shown here and sequester away things that are not useful for the OHRB. So with that, I'm going to switch it over to Wen Qing and she can take it from here.
Thank you, Tim. Hi, everyone. I'm Wen Qing Su from Villanova University. I'm the co-PI of the project with the expertise in analytical chemistry and material synthesis. So as Tim just described in our preliminary results, biochar somehow managed to accelerate the biotransformation of PCE all the way to ethane. So the next question is, what is unique about biochar? And specifically, what properties of biochar or PCM in general best supports the microbial network? To answer this question is very important because it provides critical information for us to populate specific properties of PCM to enhance bioremediation. So before I address that, I want to first talk about what is biochar and what is PCM in general. Similar to activated carbon, which is a term that most of us are familiar with, biochar also belongs to the family of pergenic carbonaceous matter, PCM. They are defined as the solid residual of the incomplete combustion of fossil fuel and biomass. They have been traditionally used as passive sorbents due to their large surface area, high pore volumes, and also the apolar surfaces. And I have included a little picture here showing the structure of activated carbon. So contrary to the conventional wisdom, recent studies suggest PCM are actually reactive and they can promote biotransformation of certain contaminants. There are already different commercial products for remedial efforts. For instance, colloidal activated carbon shown in this picture has been claimed to be able to enhance the bioremediation of hydrocarbons and chlorinated solvents. In peer-reviewed literature, both activated carbon and biochar have been shown to transfer electrons from reducing agents in the environment to microorganisms or to facilitate the interspecies electron transfer among microorganisms. So the question is, what properties is important? As you can show in this little schematic structure here, it is postulated this quinone and hydroquinone functional groups in PCM is responsible because it is a well-known redox mediator. It is also hypothesized the polyaromatic ring cluster, as shown in the second red box here, can contribute to the electron transfer because they can potentially facilitate electron transfer at a faster rate. And both of those structures of PCN could also contribute to the electron exchange capacity of PCN. However, the issue is all these properties, surface functional groups, electron exchange capacity, and the polyaromatic ring cluster, which is reflected in conductivity of PCN, vary significantly, depends on the type of the PCN. So it really hinders us to understand which property contribute to the reactivity in enhancing bioremediation. Next, please. Next, please. Well, to identify which property of PCN is important, we have developed a PCN-like polymer, which I'll refer to as PLP, to help us understand the reaction mechanisms. It is important to notice that we're not really planning on pumping those polymers in remediation, but rather we're using this PLP as a platform to inform us what are the fundamental properties we should be targeting down the line to tailor the carbon. So let's talk about PLP. Like PCN, those PCN PLP polymers also have large surface area and high microporosity. They're also highly conjugated and are amorphous. They also have superior affinity towards a series of apolar organic contaminants. However, unlike PCN, the attributes of PLP can be individually tuned and made homogeneously throughout the polymer network. For instance, this shows the synthesis route, and we can incorporate the quinone and hydroquinone pair, which I described in the previous slide, as a well-known redox mediator by selecting the R group in the linker through the synthesis process. We can also control the topology and the pore characteristics of these PLP by selecting different monomers. For instance, the top one will result in a cross-linked polymer versus the bottom one will result in linear polymer. And so far, if you look at the figure on the right, we have demonstrated that PLP has similar or comparable reactivity compared to different PCN, including graphite, which is a model PCN, and GAC, which is a commercially available product that is widely used. The reactivity is quantified by the decay rates of model contaminants as shown below. Next, please. So in this project, we're particularly interested in three aspects of the properties of PCN. The first one is the conductivity, as I previously talked about. So we will first synthesize PLP0, which is highly conjugated, but it also has no functional groups, and it is not conductive. Then using the PLP0 as a base polymer, we can tune the polyaromatic ring size of the PLP, which will result in polyaromatic ring clusters with different size that should be reflected in different conductivities. So the second properties we're interested in is the quinone and hydroquinone pair, which can be incorporated through the selection of the R groups during the synthesis. The third aspect that we're interested in is the surface charge, which we will select the carboxylic acid group and the quaternary ammonium group to incorporate into the PLP, which will confer negative and positive charge under environmental relevant condition. So if you put all of that together, we have a very nice tunable platform that will allow us to study the impacts on bioremediation from each properties, specifically conductivity, quinone hydroquinone pairs, and surface charge. Tim, next please. All right, so far we have synthesized three different polymers, PLP0, which is the highly conjugated amorphous polymer with no functionality, and it is not conductive. We then tuned the PLP0 into this PLP700, which is shown in red. It has a moderate size of polyaromatic ring cluster. The third one we have is a PLP-OH, which has quinone and hydroquinone pairs incorporated. We then conducted different surface characterization techniques. And on the right, this is the results from our solid state NMR result. As you can see, all three polymers has three peaks labeled in blue showing up, which is the evidence to support the successful synthesis of the conjugated network. Then if you're looking at the first, the black line, which is a PLPOH, there are two additional peaks showed up at 167 and 196. These are the evidences that quinone and hydroquinone pairs are successfully incorporated. And if you're looking at the red line here, which is a PLP700, it has a broad peak from 120 all the way to 160, which is indication of the formation of polyaromatic ring cluster. And by deconvoluting this peak, we can calculate the aromatic index, which is indicated in theta here. Based on the number, it suggests that we have a moderate size of PLP, polyaromatic ring cluster in this PLP. It is also supported by the conductivity measured here. So now the next step is to look at the impact of three PLPs in promoting the microbial network growth. And I'll let Tim take over.
Okay, thanks, Wenqing. So having some issues, slide moving here. Okay, so just to wrap up, we're we've just gotten started. Now that we that there are these PLP polymers, PLPs available for checking out what's how they're going to be interacting with the STC9 culture. We did start a couple initial experiments with them, and in this case, we had some poplar biochar and some this PLP0 and the PLP0700, and we threw in some GAC as kind of a comparison. And I think we're just getting started, but again, we wanted to make an important point. So in this case, with 40 milligram per liter PCE, the properties of these some of these PLP is that they can be highly absorptive. So in this in the case, it's interestingly, the poplar biochar is not very absorptive. When you throw on about 40 milligrams per liter PCE, you get almost all of it, in the aqueous phase. It's not absorbing too much. GAC, as you can see, is considered a relatively absorptive compound. It takes away about 75% of that PCE. Whereas at about the same loading, these PLPs, at least the PLP0 and the PLP0700, are a lot more absorptive. So the lesson is, and I think this was a question that was asked earlier in the webinar about some other materials, how do you, balancing the absorption capabilities of these polymers and, by extension, any materials that are made, you have to be careful with that because if the absorption is too quick, it could lead to, interfering with the growth of the OHRB. And it's also going to complicate the analyses because if you get a lot of absorption, it's a little bit harder to document the biodegradation. So that's where we're moving forward with looking at, making sure we get the loading right with some isotherms and also, there's the ability to, luckily we can, the tunable platform provides us the ability to also have some PLP that are less absorptive. And so that's where we're going to continue. So I think what's the way that we're going to end it. And I just want to thank my research team here, the students that do all the work. And Jesse Wald was a postdoc and Weilun Zhao, a PhD student in my group. And Shushaban Pradhan was a postdoc. And Han Cao is a PhD student in Wenqing's group. And I'll leave it there for some questions.
Thank you for that presentation. We do have a few questions that have come in. Hopefully we'll have time to get to all of them. I think Dr. Su actually was reading this first person's mind and answered this question on her first slide. But they asked if the PCM served as a substrate or if it was simply an attachment site for the biological culture.
That's a really good question. Yeah. I mean, we had that question when we were writing this proposal. That's exactly what we're hoping to understand using this PLP platform. So if you think about this PLP0, which essentially provides the surface area for microbes to grow, but it doesn't have functional groups and it doesn't have conductivity. So it will be able to let us see, answer that question specifically, actually.
Great, thank you. Let's see. So someone mentioned on slide 9, they wanted to know why GAC was, or the granular activated carbon, was superior to the other two PCMs in the contaminant decay.
Oh, is that the figure on the right? So that's a really good question. We're quite excited to see that, you know, GAC really performs quite well compared to others. It's not surprising if you compare GAC to graphite, because graphite really is a model PCM. It doesn't have much of a surface area. It doesn't have a lot of functional groups. And it's not necessarily surprising compared to PLP0, because that PLP0 has no functionality either. So if I were to guess, it's likely the functional groups of GAC is very different here, and typically is well known to have a mixture of different oxygenated functional groups, and they could be important in this case. They're also, you know, conductivity that could play a role. That's exactly what we're trying to get into more details in this project to delineate the contributions from each properties using this polymer network.
Great, thank you. So here's a question about the Poplar PCM. Have you tried using Poplar PCM that wasn't stored in your lab? This person is interested to know if it was because the PCM had been stored and maybe it had different microbes as a result.
So actually, the PCM that the Poplar was, it's actually pyrolyzed. The stuff that we've been working with was pyrolyzed in the lab, but we don't expect to have any specific microorganisms that would have survived that pyrolysis procedure. And the microbes that are involved are in this SDC9 culture. So it's but we can easily test out other PCM materials that came from other parts of the lab, I guess, or not in our lab, other parts of the country or elsewhere.
Yeah, and I want to just quickly jump on that, because Tim and I are talking about including some commercially available biochar for testing down the line, because, you know, making sure whatever material we're coming up with does have the commercial availability down the line is quite important, and we're aware of that.
Thank you. So when these organic contaminants are sorbed by carbonaceous materials, such as in micropores, the bioavailability of sorbed contaminants decreases a lot. So how do you improve the microbial access to those sorbed contaminants?
So it's a good point, and I think I was making that point there at the end of the presentation, that some of these PCM can be a lot more sorptive than others. So this particular biochar that we're working with is not very sorptive. And so it provides other, I guess, benefits for the microbes while not sorbing the contaminants that they need so that it can be bioavailable to them. So I think that's how we would improve it, is look at what are some of the properties of the PCM-like polymers that we can come up with that are less sorptive necessarily, but also provides a benefit to the microorganisms for contaminant transformation.
Thank you. Let's see. So do you expect the same results with other halogenated compounds?
It's possible, especially from an anaerobic standpoint, when there's anaerobic transformations of other halogenated compounds. I think that's possible. But again, the sorptive characteristics of the how sorptive, and chloroethanes are by comparison not as sorptive, maybe as say PCBs, maybe alluding to the next presentation or other compounds like that. So I think you have to balance that bioavailability aspect with what other surface properties can enhance the dehalogenation.
Yeah, and I'll also jump on that a little bit. You know, the material side is really messy, because if you think about the carbon, it's very different from one batch to the other, right? So one biochar may be performed very differently compared to another commercial available source. It's hard to compare them. And that's why, you know, we're using this tunable system to really understand what are the keys here. And then down the line, we can potentially translate that into products to make that something that's more consistent across the board.
Thank you. Okay, we're almost out of time here, but One more question is, how would you apply the biochar and the SDC9 in a field application?
Good question. I was expecting at least some of these practical questions. I guess there's a couple different ways. And so there's that colloidal, if we're thinking about a groundwater remediation scenario, there is this colloidal, putting the biochar in some kind of colloidal form that you could inject along with the SDC9. Or then there's also the biobarrier approach. If we needed to use a more granular form of it, it could be then put into a permeable or active barrier type of application. Those are the two main ones I can think of. I don't know if Wenqing, you have any other ideas on that one.
No, this is good.
Okay, I think we're out of time anyhow. So I'll thank you for that. And I did have some other questions for you. We'll pass those to you afterwards. But thank you again for your presentation. And next up we'll be hearing from Dr. Upal Ghosh. Dr. Ghosh is a professor in the Department of Chemical, Biochemical, and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, just up the street here. Dr. Ghosh, I will now turn it over to you.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. I'm seeing your presenter mode.
Okay. So thank you, everyone. Really excited to present the work that we are doing. And that's the title of our work. We're looking at leveraging the interaction with solid surfaces to enhance the bioremediation of halogenated compounds. So let me start with describing the team here. So that's me and Dr. Kevin Sowers. So I'm at the Chemical, Biochemical, and Environmental Engineering Department here at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And Kevin is at the Institute of Marine and Environmental Technology, also part of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Postdoctoral associate.
Sorry to interrupt you. We can still see your presenter mode.
I'm sorry, what?
We can still see your presenter mode.
Presenter mode. So what should I do here? Oh, I see. So the
if you click on display settings. Up on the lower left.
Oh, I see. what did I do now? And then.
So on the upper left, if you click on display settings. You can swap the view.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Challenges with two screens. So the other participants are postdoctoral associate Dr. Natalie Lombard and PhD student Yu Ting, who just joined us last year fall. And we have partners Amar Wadhawan, Hilda Fadai and Matthew Snorbridge from Arcadis, who are going to help us think about taking the science to the field. That's a big component of the work that we are planning to do. So the good thing about going last in a series of presentations is that the problem has been quite well defined by the other speakers. So I will quickly mention that we are looking at one of the distinguishing aspects of our work is that we are looking at a large spectrum going from chloroethenes to polychlorinated biphenyls. And as you know, they contaminate water resources, groundwater or surface water systems. Microbial dechlorination is feasible. There's tons of literature on the feasibility, but it's confounded by some of the slowness of the process and issues with interaction with geosolvents. And I would say that our understanding today of the dechlorination process and how it is impacted by surfaces is somewhat poor. We have a lot of empirical observations that
need to be quantified accurately to be able to be incorporated within large-scale models for groundwater or surface sediment systems. And in some cases, I may even propose that the engineering may have moved a little further than where the science is. And the reason I say that is for a successful application of a technology, it's often very important to be able to describe the science very quantitatively so that we can optimize the engineering application. And that's where there seems to be a lot of gap. And I'm really happy that NIEHS saw this gap and supported several research projects to be able to address this issue and bring the science up to where it needs to be in a very quantitative way to be able to inform these applications in the field. So the specific aims of our work involve quantitatively evaluating the effect of material properties on microbial declination. And that's an important one for us, the quantitative aspect of that description. We want to evaluate the materials on localized bacterial populations and develop innovative materials for enhanced bioremediation. And we're focusing on biochars and looking at biochars that are available, activated or not, and then also importing specific properties or altering specific properties of these biochars to be able to look, tune up or down specific characteristics that we are interested in. And then in collaboration with Arcadis, we want to be able to predict field scale performance of these innovative bioremediation materials through advanced site models. How do we incorporate the understanding into models that people would normally use in the consulting field to be able to evaluate technologies as part of a feasibility study for a Superfund site, for example. So to give you a sense of where some of the uniqueness lies in our work, we are, and the approach that we are taking, we are focusing on this particular organism. It's DF1 that Kevin's lab and in subsequent work, our engagement with Kevin, we have explored the use of this organism for PCB dechlorination. And there is quite a bit of literature on the past work that has been done on this organism. It's isolated from the field, and we can use a pure culture of a single organism to study the specific kinetics quite accurately. And that's one of the uniqueness. The other important aspect that we are excited about for that reason we chose this organism is that this organism can dechlorinate a wide range of PCB molecules going up to some of the hexachlorobiphenyls all the way down to TCE and PCE. And what that allows us is a large range of, or to observe the dechlorination process for a large range of chlorinated molecules from TCE, which might be in that KOW range of between 2 and 3, all the way up to log KOW of 6 or 7. And that's an amazing range to play with and observe some of these interactions with surfaces. And that also allows us to think about how these applications pan out in the subsurface system, in the groundwater system for chloroethenes versus in sediment remediation. We've already used black carbon materials, activated carbons, as part of the delivery of organisms into sediments that are contaminated with PCBs, and we have published on that in the past. And we have seen enhancement of the dechlorination of PCBs in the presence of the carbon. The underlying principles and the kinetics involved is something that we have a lot more work to do. So some of the specifics, it's a strict anaerobe, it's slow growing, and the cell densities are typically small, and this organism requires either a desulfur vibrio or a co-culture, and Kevin will talk more about that in the later slides. So the types of experiments we are doing involve setting up these microcosm studies, and it's important to pay attention to what's going on in these microcosms. They look simple batch reactors, but there's a lot going on there. So we have could have the dissolved electron acceptor, which could be the PCE or the PCB in that media, which is not pure water. There are a few other things in that media. And then we might be adding a carbonaceous sorbent, a black carbon material, to look at the interaction with these surfaces. Now, one of the questions is, when you are looking at a large range of hydrophobicity, what's the right way to probe and measure changes over time? We don't want to take samples of that media and then filter the organisms, because some of these compounds are difficult to measure directly through a filtration system because they absorb to anything that it comes in contact with. So our approach is to take headspace samples for the volatile compounds and then use a passive sampler to be able to measure accurately the fully dissolved concentrations of the electron acceptor over time. And we have done that in the past for PCBs. So the plot that you see in the bottom, and this is from past work, looking at the kinetics of the dechlorination of PCB61, that's a tetrachlorobiphenyl, to trichloro, which is PCB23. And that's the log concentrations in picomoles over a time period of about 3 months there. And this is the first time anyone was able to measure these kinetics and express it as a function of really dissolved concentrations of PCBs at super low concentrations in the picomoles and subpicomoles. And if you convert that to nanograms per liter, the lowest one is less than a nanogram per liter. So that work really addressed one of the big questions people had in the field. What is the reason why PCBs don't seem to go away in the field, while we have in any sediment that we go look, we find dechlorinators? Why don't they dechlorinate? And what we showed here is that it's not really a concentration bottleneck. What it boils down to is a growth bottleneck, that these concentrations are so small that these organisms can dechlorinate, but they're not getting enough energy to grow. So the steady state concentrations in the field are really small. And that was, we have published on that, and that's, by looking at the kinetics very accurately, we can make interpretations that allow us to understand what's going on and then start thinking about intervention. So the intervention there for us was the engineering of being able to grow these organisms to higher concentrations and bioaugment in the field to be able to address and get around this growth bottleneck. So coming back to what we are planning to do in our work here is to look at PCBs and PCE dechlorination in these microcosms. We want to do that and characterize these rate constants very accurately in both estuarine and freshwater media. And we want to have precise enumeration of the cell densities of DF1, both in the aqueous phase and the solid phase. And you'll see some of the work done to be able to do those measurements accurately. We have to do these measurements accurately to be able to get solid kinetic information, because then we'll be looking at small changes in those kinetics when we introduce materials. We want to be able to accurately quantify the sorption capacity in these black carbons with and without the alterations that we are planning. And then that will allow us to model the true kinetics in the presence of solids. And then we want to link that to changes over time. So here is a schematic of some of the early work that we have done. So first thing we want to be able to do in these kinds of systems is to be able to demonstrate that if we don't add the organisms, things are stable over time. So what you see on the left is for PCB61, that would go to PCB23 in the presence of the DF1 organism. But if we don't add the DF1, we are able to maintain those concentrations at levels going down below, going down to the low picomolars to thousands of picomolars, but over 90 days, they remain about constant. And the same thing on the right-hand side for PCE going to DCE, that's what DF1 would do. It's staying stable over the 50 days of measurements at three different concentrations that are shown here. We are looking at a range of black carbon materials, starting from biochars from different source biomass, and also two different kinds of activated carbons, one made from coconut shell and the other from coal, bituminous coal. Those are the two largest volume activated carbons commercially available in the market. And then we would be altering some of those properties to look at changing, for example, the electron accepting capacity or the surface area or the sorption capacity. So we want to have a range of these materials that allow us to probe how the different properties of the materials enhance or help the dechlorination activity of these organisms. And we are measuring these sorption characteristics in the media in which these experiments will be performed. The slide here shows some of the early measurements we have done of the dechlorination kinetics. So one of the unique aspects of this organism is that, as I said, is that it can dechlorinate PCBs and also PCE. So we looked at those kinetics. So if you look at the plots here on the left, for example, that's for, on the left, it's for PCB 61 going to 23. We're looking at the accumulation rate of PCB 23 in the media. And that's plotted against initial concentration of PCB 61. So that's a large range of concentration that we are looking at. And if you think about what's happening here is that as the initial concentration increases, the accumulation rate increases. And if you look at the average first order rate constant, it's about 0.02 or so, that's per day. On the right-hand side, so notice the concentration scale, it's nanomolars there. On the right-hand side, that's PCE, and those concentrations are millimolar. So six orders of magnitude higher concentrations. But when we calculate the first order rate constant, 0.04, that's about a factor of 2 to 3 different from what we saw for the PCBs, both for the estuarine media and the freshwater media. So there is something universal about the rate, intrinsic rate constant expressed in terms of the freely dissolved concentration that's invariant for PCE and PCB. So that's telling us something here, and we are trying to understand that a little better as we move along. So those rate constants are universal across the six orders of magnitude. So we are exploring that further and then looking at now, once we have a good understanding of those rate constants without the carbonaceous solvents, now we can probe, and within that system, we can look at how these different solvent materials alter those rates. I'll let Kevin take over from here and tell you more about the biology of these organisms and some of that those aspects that are really intrinsic to our project. Kevin?
Okay, so what we've been working on is normalizing the cells so that this is critical so that if we're going to measure the effects of different carbons on the kinetics, we need to be sure that all the culture conditions are normalized. So for example, when we transfer the cultures shown in the first panel, it's imperative when we do transfers, we find that if we don't let it go to 100% dechlorination, we get better growth. The cells don't like shaking, but in order to make sure the culture is somewhat mixed and consistent throughout, we find we can do a very low rate of mixing, and it doesn't affect the physiology that much. And finally, these cells grow naturally in co-culture with the disulfovibrio. So in order to eliminate any potential effect of the disulfoverbial, which doesn't dechlorinate. It just offers a growth factor to the dechlorinator. We found that we can use extract from the disulfoverbial and then remove. We don't have to have an active disulfoverbial culture in co-culture with the dechlorinator. So these are some of the growth aspects we're working on. So we've got the growth conditions so that they're going to be consistent between experiments. If you could go to the next slide. Upal, do you have control? Okay, thank you. So one of the things we're doing is PCE. We found ways to use PCB by using a reverse of a passive sampler. Essentially, we can have a steady state concentration of PCB by using adsorbing it to a passive sampler, and then it desorbs into the culture medium at a steady state concentration, depending on how much we equilibrate with the passive sampler. For PCE, what happens when you add PCE, it sinks to the bottom, and the concentration that actually goes into solution, the dissolution rate can limit the rate of the organism, which isn't looking at the true kinetics. So in order to achieve steady state, we've developed a method of just adsorbing PCE to a sand column. We can then circulate the medium through the sand column, and depending on how much PCE or the rate of flow through the sand column, we can maintain a steady state concentration of PCE in the initial culture. So that's one of the things we've been working on. We've got that set up currently so that we can grow the cells in equilibrium with a constant concentration. The next slide. The next thing is we need to normalize cell numbers. In other words, we're looking at different concentration rates or different rates of activity in response to a particular carbon. We need to normalize cell numbers in each experiment. And to do that, we developed molecular techniques. We use 16S quantitative PCR with specific primers for 16S, and we can quantify the number of cells based on this. We've gone through a number of methods for extraction. Traditionally, we're extracting from sediments. We had to adapt this now to extract from cultures. And we've got now a very reproducible, highly precise method for rapidly looking at cell numbers using quantitative PCR. And you know, we see variability between individual sampling is usually linked to the number of cells. We find PCE, we're getting about 1 × 10⁷ cells as maximum. And with PCB, it's about an order of magnitude less. So now we can accurately measure the cells and normalize the cell numbers when we're doing the kinetic studies. Next slide. And finally, we scale up the organism so that we have a source of microorganisms for these cultures. We maintain them at their highest density by semi-continuous culturing in a 20-liter fermenter. And then we can just tap off of that whatever cells we need at whatever concentration we need. And we're going to soon adapt this with a sand column. So we have continuous constant concentration of PCE for growing the cells. We can grow the cells on PCE and also use them for the PCB experiments. The cells adapt immediately to PCB. And with PCE, we get higher cell numbers. So that's how we grow and maintain them. Next slide. All right, Paul, I'll let you take over.
Sure. So I know we are going past our allocated time, but here's the quick summary. We have the experimental conditions optimized for the studies. We have an interesting finding is similar intrinsic dechlorination kinetics observed for chlorinated compounds with hydrophobicity ranging 3 to 4 orders of magnitude. We have started characterizing black carbon materials and we are preparing them for the next phase of the work. So the next steps are tailoring these black carbon for specific properties. Sorption is one of the key properties, but then the electron accepting capacity and the charge and so forth and the functional groups, we'll be looking at those as we go to the next phase of this work. Measure the tailored dechlorination kinetics on the tailored black carbons. relate those kinetics to the physicochemical properties of the black carbons. And then one of the aspects of our work also involves looking at native materials and looking at how dechlorinators in the sediment environment associate themselves with different types of particles. Do they have specific affinities of certain types of particles? And what can we learn from that as we start developing these bioamendment techniques? And not just coming from a synthetic lab standpoint, but also learning from nature. And then finally, translate the work using advanced site models. And I will end with this slide showing pictures of all of us. Happy to take questions.
Thank you for the presentation. I have just a couple of minutes here for some questions for you. So how would you completely biodegrade the PCBs once that anaerobic stage is done?
Kevin, would you like to take that?
Sure. What we do, and we're doing this in the field now, we combine the halorespiring microorganism, the anaerobe, with an aerobe. And they're both adsorbed to activated carbon pellets. And because the environment is not, it's not absolute, because of benthic activity, you have constant changing of the redox potential. Both those organisms are functional. And so what's happening is you have the dechlorinator breaking down the higher chlorinated PCBs and till you have congeners remaining that have unflanked chlorines. And those congeners are then can be broken down by the aerobe and completely mineralized through natural consortia of organisms that appear, you know, that occur in the environment.
Thank you. Okay, so we had a question about slide 6, but they asked how did you measure the electron accepting capacities of the black carbons? More specifically, using what method and under which conditions?
So this was a I have to go back and look at the specific method we use. I think it was a titration method that we used.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you. Now, in these, you seem to be looking at estuarine and freshwater conditions with particular sodium chloride molar concentrations. Have you looked at any implications with saltwater intrusion in coastal environments, for example?
Kevin, would you like to address the question with salt water for this organism and how it can switch back and forth?
Yeah, so this organism can osmoregulate. It'll grow in saline concentrations from equivalent to fresh water all the way up to full marine concentrations. And it takes very little time to adapt. For these studies, we're working, we adapt the organism, and then we consistently use the same osmolarity of the medium for all the experiments. So for these, we're focusing more on groundwater and freshwater concentrations, but these same experiments can be adapted to any salinity. And I think we propose to do mostly freshwater, but your question concerning saltwater intrusion, these same experiments could be done with that in mind to see if salinity is also a factor. I don't recall if we've written that into the proposal, but that's, you know, based on the methods we're developing here, that could be done as well because the same organism could be used.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, I have time for one more here. So with microbial dechlorinators so widely found in the natural environment, why are the natural dechlorination rates, especially for PCBs, so slow?
You want to take that, Opal?
Sure, I can take that. So that was kind of the central aspect of the work we did a few years ago to look at, this conundrum that, you know, wherever you look in these sediments with PCBs, you find these dechlorinators, but then, you know, the PCB releases into the sediments that peaked at, you know, maybe 60, 70 years ago, they haven't gone away. We still have them. And so when we looked at the kinetics, we found that these organisms, so there has been a lot of different perspectives on this in the literature. And one of the dominant perspectives was that there is a concentration bottleneck below which PCBs don't dechlorinate. And we are able to refute that with those experiments and results that I showed, that PCB dechlorination is measurable in this at the same rate constant. So if you go back to this slide here, so the slopes of those lines are basically telling you in that log scale, the first order rate constants. And across those four orders of magnitude, going down to less than a picomolar concentration of in the water phase of PCB61, the rate constant is still the same. And so there is no concentration bottleneck there. What's happening is that these organisms in the field using PCBs as electron acceptor at those low concentrations of picomolars are not making a great living. They're in a very, very poor thermodynamic niche. So although they have the enzymatic capability to dechlorinate, it's not helping them in their growth. So if you think about microbial ecology in those systems where you have an organism that hardly grows, their steady state concentration is going to be really small. So when Kevin goes and measures these in the sediments, he gets something like, correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, like 10 raised to 2 cells per ml of sediments.
Yes.
And
that's the case.
And in our last paper, what we showed is that at that level of organism density in sediments, with the kinetic rate constants that we have measured in the lab, it would take centuries for PCBs to go away. And that's indeed what we are seeing in the field. Now, the thing that we can change, and which is the innovative part of what Kevin has been able to do, and I've been able to help with some of the engineering of it to the field, is that I can break that growth bottleneck by bringing these organisms back to the lab, isolating them, and that allows me to grow them at maybe multiple orders of magnitude faster on PCE in a reactor, get larger numbers of those organisms, but then I have to bioaugment back in the field to bring up those numbers in the sediments from 10 raised to 2 cells per ml to something like 10 raised to 5 to 6 cells per ml. And then we start seeing changes in the PCB concentrations in the sediments in the time scales we like to see those changes happen, which is in the months to years and not decades to centuries. So I don't know if it answered your question completely, but that's basically what we are seeing. It's really the growth bottleneck, which is linked to the slow rate of dechlorination that we see for PCBs in the sediment environment. And we can break that by bioaugmentation.
Thank you. Thanks for that answer. Well, this is all we have time for today. So I want to thank Dr. Ghosh and Dr. Sowers and all of our other presenters. But please stick around for just a moment, participants. I have a few reminders for you. So first, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage. This website will remain active and contains important resources such as links to download these presentation materials, contact information for the speakers, and a link to our feedback form. And we ask you to consider filling out that online feedback form because we will look at your comments, and we are always trying to continue to improve the content and our delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page if you need a record of your participation in today's event. I would also like to remind our participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any of these webinars. For more information on Clumen webinars, please refer to the clumen.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly e-newsletter TechDirect. We encourage you to visit the SRP Project Progress in Research webpage and subscribe to the RISC e-learning listserv for information about upcoming sessions. You can also follow SRP on Twitter. I would like to encourage everyone to join us for the third and final session in this series on May 13th. During that last session, our presenters will discuss strategies to improve how plants and fungi remove hazardous substances from soil. If you'd like to join the webinars, our registration is filling up fast, so we encourage you to register now. If you can't attend, archives will be made available after the event, so you can come back to these pages for links to the archive archives after the webinars are held. So with that, it's time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question and we didn't have time to get to it, we will pass those along to the presenters who we follow up. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on Cluin. I would like to sincerely thank our presenters for their